You're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with RAFA, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm joined this week by Daniel Freib.
Hello.
Hello, Daniel. And out there in your Majorcan hacienda, Rob Hatch.
Buen dia.
Hello, Rob and Daniel. We've not joined by Lionel this week, unfortunately, but Rob's standing in. Hopefully you can be as in character.
Like when Gary and Robbie got back together.
I'll try and be as miserable as possible. We'll see what happens.
Curmudgeonly. Well, I wasn't going to say that. But speaking of Lionel, he does have his news roundup, and he's asked me to kick it off with the question, where are you, Lionel?
Thanks very much, Richard. I've been cycling in the Cotswolds for a couple of days, and it's been very nice too. But it's been a very busy week of racing, hasn't it, with the Critérium du Dauphiné coming down to a barnstorming finish on Sunday. Before that, Thomas de Gent won the opening stage and held the yellow and blue jersey for much of the week. Then Richie Porte won the individual time trial and took the lead after Friday's stage two Lap Motte Cervélex, which was won by Astana's Jakob Fuglsang. Sky's Peter Kennett won Saturday's stage to Alpe d'Huez, which was climbed from the Col de Sarenne side. He was away with his fellow British rider Ben Swift, but Kennett pulled away in the closing kilometres to win the stage. The question is, has that been enough to force his way into Sky's Tour de France team? But the race itself was decided on the final day with an explosive, short 115-kilometre stage that finished at the Plateau de Solaison. And what a stage it was. Alejandro Valverde and Fabio Aru piled the pressure on Porte early on, and Porte was left without much support by his BMC team. Then there was a moment of tactical inattention, and the Australian was soon on the back foot, and for a while it looked like Chris Froome was doing more than enough to turn the tables on his former teammate. But that was only half of the story, because Porte mounted a serious fight back, Froome faltered, and Fuglsang surged through the middle to win the stage and take the overall honours by just 10 seconds from Porte. Daniel Martin finished third and Froome slipped to fourth. There's a lot of pre-Tour de France racing going on at the moment. The Tour de Suisse is underway, the Ster ZLM Tour in Netherlands is also underway, and the Route du Sud will be held this week as well. Mark Cavendish is due to return to action after, well, hopefully shaking off mononucleosis or glandular fever. He's going to be riding the Tour of Slovenia. There was an equally gripping edition of the Women's Tour, which was won in fine style by Kasia Nieuwendomme of the WM3 Pro Cycling Team. She had a string of podium places at the Ardennes Classics in April, remember? But she finally won a World Tour race by breaking away and winning the opening stage in Kettering in quite decisive fashion. Her lead on the finish line was 1 minute 42 over Marianne Vos. The other stages were won by Amy Peters, Chloe Hosking and Sarah Roy, with Jolien Dehorder winning the first women's tour race to be held in London. Hannah Barnes was the best placed British rider overall. She was third. Have a listen to the latest episode of the Cycling Podcast Féminin. Richard and Orla were right at the heart of the race, travelling in separate team cars during the Stoke-on-Trent stage. Also in London this weekend was the RAFA Nocturne, a packed evening of racing culminating with the women's and men's Criterium events. Lucy Shaw of the Drops team won the women's race, and JLT Condor's Brenton Jones took the men's event. Away from the racing, the long-awaited independent review into British cycling has been published. It doesn't make happy reading for British cycling, and there have also been claims that the report has been watered down from an earlier version that had been leaked. We will no doubt return to that subject in the future. And finally, the former president of the UCI, Hein Verbruggen, has died at the age of 75. He had been ill with leukemia. The Dutchman was the 8th UCI president, taking over from the Spaniard Luis Puig in 1991. Verbruggen was the UCI president during an era when the professional sport failed to get to grips with EPO abuse and blood doping. In 1998, during the Festina affair, he was in Cuba at a UCI Congress, which was held to coincide with the Junior World Track Championships. He did make a very brief visit to the tour and then famously went on holiday to India, more or less declaring there's nothing to see here. Later, there was controversy over a payment to the UCI by Lance Armstrong. The allegation was that the money was paid to cover up a positive doping test, although Verbruggen and Armstrong denied that and it was never proved. They said that the money was donated in order to buy a Newsmix machine to analyse blood samples and help the fight against doping. A BBC investigation alleged that Verbruggen had been paid by Japanese race organisers to include the Keirin in the Olympic Games programme, another allegation that was not proved. Verbruggen was very litigious. He sued the Festina soigneur Willie Voigt, he sued Floyd Landis, the WADA chief Dick Pound, and the journalist Paul Kimmage, to name a few. He was also instrumental in allowing pro riders to compete in the Olympic Games, which they did for the first time in 1996. And it's fair to say that during Verbruggen's term as president, the sport's popularity outside its European heartland did increase. And there were several efforts to globalise or mondialise the sport, as Verbruggen was fond of saying. Anyway, he was succeeded by Ireland's Pat McQuaid in 2005. And that concludes the news for this week.
Thank you for that, Lionel. Well, Daniel, you were at the Dauphiné last week, and we're going to start off this week talking about the Dauphiné. We're going to also talk again about the Hammer Series, because you've got some thoughts about that. It was a couple of weeks ago now. Lionel and I discussed it a little bit in last week's episode, but sure, you've got a bit to add. I'll talk about that in connection with the Women's Tour, kind of, which I was at last week and features in this month's Cycling Podcast Femina, which has just been released. But yeah, the Dauphiné, what a race that was, and it sets up the Tour de France very nicely indeed. Jakob Fuglsang, as Lionel told us there, was the winner. But much to talk about, eh, Daniel?
I've got a question first, Rich. Where was Lionel? Was he in Watford?
He's on a cycling expedition, I believe, with his mate Simon Gill, the photographer.
What a peculiar thing to do. Yeah, the Dauphiné. So are we going to kick off with the Dauphiné?
Oh, I think so. I think it's a race on everybody's lips, minds. You were there. As I said, Jakob Fuglsang, the winner. Chris Froome went for glory on the Sunday. So much intrigue. I mean, Richie Porte was in the yellow jersey. Looked pretty safe. He had a lead of a minute before the final, very short stage. That stage, some people were calling one of the most exciting stages they've seen. It was kind of full on, lots of attacking. And Froome eventually collapsed. Port rallied and came back pretty strongly, but it was Fuglsang that went off for the win. Now, to me, it reminded me a bit of the 2014 Dauphiné, which was won by Andrew Talansky, and that was notable, I suppose, for Chris Froome not winning it. And likewise this time, what does it tell us about the Tour de France? There are so many talking points. There's Froome, there's Richie Porte, there's Dan Martin, there's Louis Menkes, there's Emmanuel Buchmann, the young German rider who's starting to ride pretty well. Roman Bardet, there's Esteban Chavez, who's on his way back from injury and didn't really show at the Dauphiné that he will be in contention at the Tour. Disappointing performance from Simon Yates. I mean, you could go on and on. Valverde, disappointing from him. Contador, a curious performance from Contador on and off the pike. I suppose the question, Daniel, I mean, we saw a thrilling race, very aggressive. What does it tell us about the Tour? Because as a lot of people have pointed out, the Tour is unlikely to be raced in the same way. And for all that Richie Porte lost the yellow jersey on the final day, you know, he looks to be in exceptional form, has done all season. He goes into the Tour as one of the favourites, despite never having finished on the podium of the Tour. What can we read into the Dauphiné in relation to the Tour de France?
Well, I think there was a lot of focus on Froome's performance, which was considered by most to be a fairly poor performance or subpar performance. The noises coming out of Sky all week were that they weren't worried. Of course they are going to say that, but there's no doubt that going into the Tour having not won a race, and then on the other side of the proverbial fence, or almost physical fence, in Nice or in Monaco, is Richie Porte, who has had a spring very much like the spring that Wiggins had before he won his Tour de France, and springs that Froome has had before he's won his Tour de France, where he's been, well, he should have won the Dauphiné, won the Tour of Romandy, and won the Tour Down Under. So it's intriguing. And then at the same time, you've got two teams, BMC, which really let Porte down, make no mistake about that, on the last day. They were very good on the penultimate day, but were brittle, as against Team Sky, who are probably going to be as strong as ever, if not even stronger. You know, they've got Wout Poels coming back, who he hopes to be ready for the Tour. Kwiatkowski's going really well. They've got Landa, who rode a great Giro, now building up to the Tour. So, and again, Froome, who's doesn't seem particularly flustered, particularly phased, at least publicly. So, I mean, it's quite intriguing.
Yeah, I enjoyed my little post-Giro detox, actually, before tuning in about a third of the way through the Dauphiné last week. And oh, it was nice to get a different perspective, and the Spanish broadcasters and commentators were actually full in praise of Sky and Froome with the way they race, not necessarily with Froome's form. And if Froome can find the sort of form that we know he's capable of, although it's a big ask maybe with 3 weeks to go until the Tour, we're not sure where he's going to find that, then he's got that sort of extra attacking nature and the way that he's been riding, the different way he's been riding, the descents, the will to take it up early than we've seen in the past. So he does have something extra to his armoury now, but does he have the form, which I think is the principal thing that has won him big races in the last few years.
I mean, you always wonder, Rich, as well, whether there's a fatigue factor. I remember speaking a few years ago to Fred Grapp, the FDJ coach, about how at Sky in particular, they do a lot of training camps. They, you know, sort of famously, notoriously, whatever, those training camps are very difficult. They work very hard. They have this mantra of, what is it, training to race or racing to train. Anyway, the training is supposedly designed to be harder than the racing. And I remember Fred Grapp saying that this was something that maybe riders might be able to sustain for a year or 2 years, but as time wears on, then it might start to grind someone down. And Chris Froome is now in his, what is his kind of, since 2012, this is his sixth season really on that treadmill, and you know, does that explain why he's not quite at the same level this year? I don't know, but it's one possible explanation.
We don't know, of course, what level of fatigue these riders came into the Dauphiné with. I mean, Valverde has been training very hard, apparently at altitude. The Dauphiné serves different purposes, doesn't it, for different riders, and it's possible that for one reason or another, I mean, Froome hasn't had the build-up, the preparation he would have wanted at the Romandy, for example, where there was very bad weather. It's possible that he's then overcompensated for that with an extra hard training block at altitude, say, and he's come into the Dauphiné perhaps a little bit more tired than he would normally. We don't know. The riders that we saw, the form that we saw them in at the Dauphiné, they're all at kind of different stages. You know, we've got Fabio Aru coming back from injury and looking really good. Esteban Chavez also coming back from injury, not looking so good, but that doesn't necessarily indicate how either of those riders is going to perform at the Tour. They could just be at different places in their recovery. But what you say, Rob, about Froome and his weapon, his new weapon of descending, I mean, two things. One is he has become a very good descender, and Dan Lloyd made the comment on Twitter that that's something that's changed completely from the early days when he was a notoriously bad bike handler. He's become a very, very good descender, and he dropped some of his rivals on descents just by taking more risks and going quicker than them. He's become very good at it, and it's a real potent weapon for him now, and that's interesting. But what's also interesting is just the fact that he's willing to put it on the line to such an extent in the Dauphiné, a race that he's won before, that in the context of the Grand Tours doesn't mean an awful lot. And it says quite a lot about Froome the competitor, as did his performance on the final day when, you know, he and Richie Porte are friends, training partners. They've been close, certainly, in the past. And I don't know whether it's a phony war, but he certainly did all that he could to beat Porte, and in the process, you know, allowed Fuglsang to create the opportunity for him to win the race. But there didn't seem to be any sentiment at all in the way that Froome rode on Sunday.
No, I thought Froome did give his all to win. I think he said as much as well, even though he obviously tried to dampen things down a bit. The disappointment, saying that, OK, it wasn't quite the Tour, and the important thing is the Tour, but nevertheless, it was a race he wanted to win. I thought that something that was really interesting, the contrasting attitudes of Froome and Alberto Contador, because Contador turned up and said, no, I'm not going to the red, I'm not going to give too much, I'm not going to burn myself out, the Tour's the important thing. And Alberto Contador's had, remember, a lot of second and third places, hasn't he, this year? And you'd have thought that he'd be the man that would be desperate for a win as well, with not having one the Tour de France in quite a few years now.
Yeah, we sat down with a few journalists, sat down with Contador a couple of nights from the end, and Steven de Jong, his director sportif, was there, his Trek Segafredo director sportif, and de Jong said that he'd banned Alberto Contador from attacking at the Dauphiné, and he didn't attack, but it was because he looked pretty ropey, didn't he? He did not look good at all, and he lost a whole load of time on the final day. And, you know, Contador, he was in quite sort of expansive, eloquent form, in fact, speaking in English, speaking very well in English, and which he's been reluctant to do in the past. But he ran through every Tour de France since the last Tour de France that he won was, well, that without being stripped, the title was 2009, and he ran through every Tour de France since then. And he kind of he outlined and itemized all the problems he'd had since then. And, you know, all of them were perfectly legitimate, all of them quite logical. But again, it's the kind of thing that happens to riders when their advantage starts to slip. And you know, going back to Froome, you know, whether it's illness, whether it's a slight lack of form or whatever, could it be that he has just teetered over the precipice where these, you know, these small factors, these small inconveniences, they start to, or they effectively eat away at the competitive advantage that he's held for so long? It might be. But you know, it was interesting, Rich, the whole discussion about the friendship between Port and Froome. I mean, there was a big piece in L'Equipe on Saturday, or on Sunday morning before the big battle, finishing at, well, the final stage of Plateau de Solisson, and talking about how Port had how at BMC they had a real problem, or they were getting really frustrated last year because they felt as though Port was still riding for Froome, almost riding as his friend, hadn't really learned or hadn't really sort of figured out yet that they were rivals now. And that kind of, I suppose, shed an intriguing light on what did happen on Sunday.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science and Sport for sponsoring Cycling Podcast. A reminder that all our listeners can get 20% off at scienceandsport.com by entering the code CPOD20 for 20% off all your Science and Sport products. We'll carry on talking about the Dauphiné. There's more to say, not least about the winner, Jakob Fuglsang. Final point, just before we move on to him, on Contador, because interesting, Stephen de Jong saying he'd banned him from attacking, because I remember an interview I did with him at the Vuelta last year, which was in the podcast, about, you know, the fact that the way that Contador rode the Vuelta last year probably cost him the race. And you know, that attacking instinct that he has is the thing that might prevent him from winning another Grand Tour. And I said to de Jong, do you not think about approaching the race a little bit differently, him riding a little bit more conservatively? And he said, oh, no, you'll never change Contador. You'll never change the way he rides. That's just the way he is. But it did seem at the Dauphiné that he was riding in a different way. That could be, as you say, Daniel, just because he was going like a bag of washing. I don't know. But we'll find out at the Tour de France. We'll find out at the Tour, I guess, if we see a new Contador, a new conservative Contador.
We're into the realm of speculation. Lionel would not be amused.
Well, we can speculate as much as we like with Lionel not here.
Just to finish that point on Contador, I think that, in fact, it's his USP, isn't it? He knows that. It's what makes Alberto Contador. I think that he, even in exchange for another big Tour de France win, that is something that he would be reluctant, if not definitely not going to compromise on ever.
And he's fully understood this now. And he's, yeah, it was interesting. He talked last week about wanting to go back in a few years' time and watch compilations of himself on YouTube. You know, I mean, we all do that. We're all guilty of that.
We all do that.
In our spare time. But, you know, he really has taken on this image and this mantle of the great entertainer and the showman. And that's almost become a kind of vindication and justification of the frustrations that he has had, because, you know, at least he's putting on a show. The other thing that I took from Contador last week was that he's nowhere near ready to retire. I think if this year's Tour de France was a crushing disappointment, it's not inconceivable that he would decide to give up. But I think that in his mind at the moment, he might have 3-4 more years.
There's actually talk this week in the Italian and Spanish press of him doing the Giro and the Vuelta next year as well, and maybe saying goodbye at the Vuelta España, or maybe saying goodbye at the Tour de France next year. But I think he certainly wants another crack at the Giro as well. So I don't think at all that it's over yet.
So the winner, Jakob Fuglsang, you know, a strong rider, one of these riders whose problem is that he's pretty good at everything. And, you know, he's a former mountain biker. We saw in 2014 the cobbled stage in the Tour de France, how important a teammate he was for Vincenzo Nibali. And watching him there, the way that he rode the cobbles, he thought, you know, this guy could ride a good Paris-Roubaix. He's a good stage race rider. He's a good one-day rider, as he showed at Olympic Road Race last year. He's always been a rider who can do everything pretty well. And so, you know, I think his heart has been in trying to become a GC rider, but he's a bit bigger than most of the GC riders. So you know, he's a strong rider, as we saw. I don't think he's going to win the Tour de France, but it's contract year for him as well. This could be the race that he's remembered for, the biggest result of his career.
Well, yeah, Rich, I asked him a couple of times in the week whether he thought he was in the process of moving up a level, entering a sort of new dimension as a rider, and he obviously hopes so. Hadn't won a race for 5 years, I don't think, before his stage win at the Dauphiné. And they needed a win. I mean, they needed a win for sentimental reasons as well, because they hadn't had one since Michele Scarponi died, and I think it was the 22nd of April. So it was obviously a big deal for Astana. Astana, we talked at the start of the year, they had a very thin roster as far as classics were concerned. They're always going to be reliant really on Aru, and well, we didn't realise how important Fuglsang was going to be. His upturn in fortunes at the weekend, Fuglsang, or his, well, the fantastic weekend that he did have, coincided with Alexander Vinokourov arriving with his white cat. He's almost sporting a white moustache these days. It looks like my antenna were twitching, because it looked like he'd just finished his, it was the froth from his cappuccino, but I ruled that out immediately, because it was mid-afternoon, and you know, he's a man of impeccable taste, so Vino would never do such a thing. But yeah, we've seen in the past that he is able, he does know how to exert a little bit of pressure on his troops, doesn't he?
And we know that, I think he was very confident, quietly confident about Fuglsang this year as well. Sean Kelly and I bumped into Vinokourov at the buses at the Paris-Nice, and we were wondering, you know, what's going on with the team, a bit like everybody, where you're going to get a win from basically this year, and he just said no, we're going with Fuglsang for the Tour, and Lopez might go with him, who I know has come back to racing this week at the Tour of Swiss, by the way, after his awful leg break last week, and that pressure could turn into contracts, as it's already done this week for Luis León Sánchez, who's...
I don't think he broke his leg last week, Rob.
Did I say that? I'm sorry.
That would be amazing. That would be incredible.
That would have been a remarkable recovery, wouldn't it?
We see some very suspicious things in cycling, but that would have been...
I thought I might have missed it in my week detox after the Giro. Anyway, I know that Luis León Sánchez has signed a new contract this week. That was definitely this week, by the way, with Astana for next year. And as you mentioned, it is contract year for Fuglsang. He's 32 now, 14 wins in his career after the three you've got to add on this week, the two stages in the overall. And he's already a Grand Tour stage winner. Now, for you guys, looking ahead to the Tour de France, what should he do? GC or go and win a stage? Or both?
Try and win a stage.
Just maintain that remarkable hairline of his, which I always admire. It's phenomenal. But yeah, Aru was extremely impressive at the Dauphiné. He's a very spiky character, Aru. I put it to him one day that this was the best he'd ridden for about a year, and he said, well, of course it is, because I've had so many problems, I've had so many physical problems. And the noises coming out of the Astana camp all week at the Dauphiné were that they don't get on particularly well, Fuglsang and Aru, yet they dovetail pretty well. There were a few moments in the race where you did sort of wonder when they kind of passed each other on the road and they didn't even exchange a glance or a word. But Fuglsang was pretty diplomatic and conciliatory and sort of suggesting that they were riding very much as a sort of dynamic duo after the race. But they're going to be very potent at the Tour. And Vino also said, and this is true to an extent, I think, that teams, well, their opponents are no longer really used to riding against teams with two leaders. It's true that we don't often see that. We haven't seen that for a few years with very, very strong teams going in with multiple leaders, mainly because it never works. And Vino should know better than anyone that it doesn't work, because he was one prong of the most shambolic trident ever to be fielded at the Tour de France when he rode for T-Mobile with Andreas Klöden and Jan Ulrich.
I was reading in Gazzetta dello Sport this week that Giuseppe Martinelli, the director sportif, didn't want to have to make the decision. He was saying that, well, I think, naturally, he'd like Aru to be his leader because that's the rider he's closest to. But he seemed to suggest that Vinokourov wanted Fuglsang in charge. He seemed to suggest that Vinokourov wanted to keep options open. And he said, I'm going to leave Vino to make that decision. And if Lopez comes out of the Tour de Suisse well, then they've got another headache, because this is a man who in Colombia is more highly rated than Nairo Quintana, certainly in terms of potential.
I mean, whether Fuglsang and Aru get on or not, we saw on Sunday the value of just having bodies up there in that very select group. And saw a bit with AG2R as well. Veer Moz was quite helpful for Bardet at one point. And the thing that, as you said earlier, Daniel, the thing that probably cost poor the race was not having any help and being left on his own and isolated in the way that he was. And so if that plays out at the Tour, where on the evidence of the Dauphiné, we don't know how reliable that evidence will prove to be, but if the Tour is quite an open race, it could be that we have a situation a bit like 2008, CSC had such a strong team, where having strong teammates up there could really help. I wanted to ask you about, well, two things, actually. I mean, Orica and the Simon Yates, Esteban Chavez performances. I mean, Simon Yates, 13th overall, Chavez a bit further back. What was your take on them? And Chavez clearly, you know, on his way back, but will he be ready for the Tour? And Simon Yates, did we not expect a little bit more from him at the Dauphiné?
I think maybe Simon Yates was slightly below par, certainly on the last day. He did try and attack, but didn't quite have the legs. But it was a very, very strong field. I think his performance was perhaps not flattered by the comparison with Buchmann, is on paper an inferior rider. He's a guy who doesn't really have much of a change of pace, but he sort of hangs on. He's often in the second group in the mountains. But to see Yates beaten comprehensively by Buchmann in the white jersey competition was a bit of a surprise to me. Chavez, I thought, did well for his first race back. He hadn't raced since February. Yeah, and, you know, by all accounts, a pretty nasty knee problem. He kept telling me all week that his knee was perfect now. And he seemed fairly chipper. I mean, he got in the break on the last day. Okay, didn't go too well for him. But I think he'll be okay. I mean, I don't think he's going to win the Tour de France. And, you know, it's interesting, with so little time trialing in the Tour de France this year, there's the 14-kilometer opening time trial in Dusseldorf and then the 23-kilometer final time trial in Marseille. And that would maybe incline you to think that it's going to be less important this year. And a lot of these guys who've been building towards the Tour would have put less emphasis on it over the winter. But I've spoken to a few guys about that, well, I did at the Dauphiné particularly, and they said, well, no, the opposite is almost true, because we saw last year at the Tour de France how everything's so close now in the mountains, and it's so difficult to gain a minute or 2 minutes, even with a huge attack, you know, the attacks that we kind of used to see in the bad old days, that actually time trialing is almost becoming more important, and you need fewer kilometres of time trialing to make the time gaps that, you know, you used to make over sort of 50, 60 kilometres in time trial. So I think Chavez is really ruled out of any hope of winning the Tour de France purely by the time trialing, regardless of whatever injury problems he's had. For the moment, I think he'll improve over the next couple of years.
Can I just say, while we're on the subject of time trial as well, as far as the Dauphiné is concerned, we should give an honourable mention to Dan Martin, shouldn't we? Of course, he's not known for being able to maybe
Disco Dan,
do the top time trials that we know could win him a Grand Tour, for example. But on current form, I think we were talking about it last night, he's certainly a podium's not out of the question at all. He's in the form of his life in stage racing, isn't he?
He is. He's going well.
He is. Finally in the Dauphiné, Peter Kenyuk and his winner, Alpdues, friend of the podcast, Peter Kenyuk. Will he give us an interview now, I wonder? I mean, David Miller was very good, I thought, on ITV's coverage. You know, Gary Imlach put it to him that Kenyuk was 50-50 for the Tour team before the Dauphiné, and Miller put it now at 51-49, which is probably about right. I don't think, I mean, speaking to Dave Brailsford at the Giro, I don't think Kenyuk was anywhere near their thoughts for the Tour team. Will winning Alpdues change anything? I suspect probably not.
I think not. Kenyuk himself, you know, saw him on Sunday or Saturday after he'd won the stage, and he sort of shook his head and said, well, you know, I don't know what it is with me, but some days I think I should jack this whole cycling lark in. And kind of that reflects the fact that he does have quite a lot of days where he struggles, and he has days where he's absolutely brilliant. And that's not necessarily what Sky will be looking for. Although they do, you know, they operate this sort of rotation system whereby the mountain domestiques, they're ordered to, you know, do a lot of work one day and then maybe step off the gas the next day and let someone else step into the breach, which you would think would suit a guy like that who perhaps isn't necessarily that consistent. However, you know, they got an awful lot of options, haven't they? And Kenyuk was also, I think he's a bit miffed that he always comes into form. We said this, he always comes into form in May and June in particular. And by that point, they've already drawn up their long list, which has subsequently become almost, well, it's a short list, and he's almost excluded, he's almost out of the reckoning by that point, and that's happened again this year. And, you know, also you think about the Vuelta and the kind of course there is at the Vuelta, his performance in the Vuelta last year. I think that they and he might be better served sending him there, to be honest.
Hi, I'm Arjun. I've been working at Rafa for just over 2.5 years. I'm the marketing executive. So I look after paid media, paid search, and a bit of content marketing. Best thing about Rafa, it's got to be the amount of cycling you get to do. I mean, there's always people that you can go for rides with. Coffee, free coffee is amazing. Yeah, so I got into cycling a bit before uni, did a bit throughout, and then obviously since coming here, picked it up a bit more. Just kind of amateur cycling, nothing too serious. I don't shave my legs.
The Rafa Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kits, and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
Thank you very much, as ever, to Rafa, our main sponsor, which allowed us to cover, or helped us to cover the Giro last month. And we're gearing up for the Tour de France at the moment. Orla and I were working at the Rafa Nocturne at the weekend there, which was a tremendous occasion in central London. Very enjoyable indeed. Huge crowds out. Beautiful weather as well. I was also last week at the Women's Tour, which finished in London on Sunday. And it was won by Kasia Nevedoma. Fantastic performance from her after winning on stage one. You can hear a lot more about the Women's Tour in our latest cycling podcast, Femina, which has been released this week. Lots of interviews in that. And Orla and I spent one of the stages in a couple of team cars, some insight from there. And one of the riders who rode very well at the Women's Tour was Hannah Barnes. She finished third overall, second on a couple of stages. Let's hear from her now. Here's Hannah Barnes.
I guess you're reflecting on a successful week, second today. You would have liked a stage win, I guess, but to finish on the podium overall, you must be pretty satisfied with that.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a really hard, long week with the long stages. Yesterday was hard, and I was able to be in pretty much every move that went on the climbs, which was, yeah, I was really happy with. And then today I knew that I had to finish, well, win those intermediates and then finish really high up on the sprint. Yeah, we had a team plan, and I mean, the start when Bowles split it, yeah, I was happy to be there and to win that first intermediate, and then it came back together and my team did an unbelievable lead out for me, and then I won that second one, and then I was joint third, so I knew that I had to do well in that final sprint, and yeah, I did. I mean, it was a hard sprint, and I was gaining on Jolene, but she's just such a strong rider that I wasn't quite able to get there, and I would love to have got there, but yeah, we can be happy with that.
Just finally, I want to ask you about La Course. What do you think about the format?
It's interesting. I mean, the Hammer Series for the men last weekend, I think a lot of people are going into that with mixed views on it. For me personally, I think it's the best race I've ever watched. So yeah, I'm not going to say anything negative, positive about the race, because honestly, I have no idea what can happen.
I mean, are you open to this sort of, these innovations, these new ideas? Particularly having seen how exciting the Hammer Series was.
Yeah, I mean, it's great to have different variety in racing. I mean, every year you have more or less the same races, and you know what's going to happen in those races more or less. So yeah, I mean, that Hammer Series was the most exciting race I've seen in a really long time, and I mean, La Course could be the same. For me, yeah, it's not on my calendar, but yeah, it's gonna be quite an exciting race, I think.
So that was Hannah Barnes there. Hannah Barnes, that leads us actually quite nicely into our next segment of discussion about the Hammer Series, because her other half, Theo Gegenhart of Team Sky, was one of the riders who really shone in the Hammer Series.
You make it sound so unromantic.
What would you prefer? Partner?
Is that the best you can do? Other half? Make it sound so, you know, one of the blossoming romance, the great blossoming romances of this wonderful, in this wonderful sport. And, you know, that's as florid as you can come up with. Other half, the missus.
It wasn't meant with any disrespect or anything. Just, well, you know, her boyfriend, Theo Gegenhart, rode very, very well at Hammer Series. And in fact, speaking to quite a lot of the riders at the Women's Tour about La Course, which is in a new format this year, and it's a very interesting, innovative concept whereby they've got a mountain stage on one day and then what they're calling the chase the following day, which is a time trial for the top 20, starting with the time gaps they had on the mountain. Now, a lot of them were very, very sceptical about this until they watched the Hammer series, including Hannah Barnes. She said that the Hammer series was the most exciting racing she'd ever seen. And quite a few of the women, Lizzie Dagenham being one of them, spoke about now quite looking forward to La Course having watched the Hammer series. We didn't talk about it with you, Daniel, last week because you didn't join us, or indeed you, Rob. I mean, what were your thoughts on the Hammer series?
Well, Richard, I think my views on this subject are well known. Since my cocktails with Graham
Bartlett in the desert
on the rooftop terrace in Abu Dhabi, overlooking the Arabian Gulf. Well, Rich, I thought instead of hearing what I thought of it, what I made of it, first of all, I'll just read out a bit of newspaper coverage, some newspaper cuttings that I've found. Here we go. Although it picked up later, along with the atmosphere, the new era had been sent blazing into life with all the combustible properties of two sticks rubbed together by a Boy Scout. Gimmicks, and let's face it, that is what much of this is, have a short shelf life, and people will only return if the sport proves enduring. The public, especially teenagers, are not easily hoodwinked if quality is missing. My guess is that it will, in the end, have a negligible effect on crowds, finance, standards, or interest. The general impression that these are fun events will serve the purpose of attracting young people who are used to noise, spectacle, and instant gratification. But the game's intrinsic qualities, or the sport's intrinsic qualities, will remain its chief attraction. Now, Rich, they were not reactions from Lionel Burney, Richard Moore, William Fotheringham, the great plumes of professional cycling to the Hammer series. That was a reaction in June 2003 to the first round of games in 2020 cricket. Now, 14 years on, 2020 cricket has, I mean, you know, financially, I don't know what the balance is now between Test cricket and 2020 cricket, but by all accounts, it's very much part of the furniture in professional cricket, and to a large extent it has eclipsed the longer, more traditional form of the game. And you heard there the sort of skepticism that greeted the advent of 2020 cricket, and you know, when you compare the reaction to the first Hammer series, I think there has been an awful lot of skepticism, but generally people have been more positive than they were vis-a-vis 2020 cricket. That is maybe a taste of what is to come and a glimpse into the future of this kind of event. And certainly, you know, speaking to people at the Dauphiné who had been there, both riders, directors, sportifs, they were effusive about it. Social media was not so effusive about it. I thought there was a lot of nitpicking. You know, obviously the scoring system was needs a lot of work. It wasn't easily comprehensible. It wasn't particularly, I didn't think, that well conceived. But, you know, I mean, the Hammer series is trying to reinvent cycling in a way that 2020 cricket was not really trying to reinvent cricket. That was more about just changing the length of the game, and it was still basically the same concept. I think the Hammer series is trying something much more ambitious, and it's shifting the emphasis from individuals to teams. And you know, the chase was incredibly innovative, and I thought we saw more innovations in 3 days of cycling, of bike racing, than we had seen or than we would usually see in 2-3 decades of Grand Tour or one day racing.
Now, I'm a big cricket fan. I grew up as a cricket fan. That was my sport when I was a kid, alongside football as well. And I'm not sure that it's necessarily going to be the same for cycling. We've got to wait and see. We've got to watch it. We've got to treat anything new with, even if it's with a bit of scepticism, with positive scepticism, if you like, because we've got to welcome anybody who wants to try and make cycling better. That's the first thing I think I'm going to say. In terms of what 2020 did for cricket, if it has the same effect, then we're probably in for a treat. Because if you look at the international game now, including Test cricket, I'll keep this very brief for anybody who hates cricket. There are probably quite a lot of you listening.
We're going to move on to speed golf in a minute.
The fielding's a lot better. Everything is quicker. Everything is much cleaner. People are fitter. People train harder. The batting is technically better. It's more aggressive. The bowling, well, they've had to change their tactics.
Sorry, we're still talking about the Hammer series here.
Well, exactly. But if it can have the same effect on cycling as we've seen in cricket, and in terms of financial things, just look at the Indian Premier League. Absolute superstars and silly amount of money. More money almost that's involved in Premier League football over there in that as well. I think owning an Indian Premier League team costs a lot more money than owning a Premier League football team. All sorts of stuff like that. And it's got to be managed right. I'm sure there are imperfections in the way that cricket's run. But if you can improve cycling as we know it's been globalised, but we also know that the if you just take a look at the calendar at the minute, it's a mess. It's all over the place. And we've talked about this a lot earlier during the year, and it's a sort of a theme that's carrying on throughout professional cycling as we go on. But if it can have that same effect, then I think we're in for interesting times. Whether it's wholly positive, wholly negative, I'm not sure. But I'm not sure what the first reactions were to that first weekend of racing.
I would echo what Rob says about also about the influence that the Hammer Series is likely to have, things leaking from the Hammer Series into, well, we've already seen something leak from the Hammer Series, you know, into, well, ASO's way of thinking with this chase idea for La Course. And yeah, I think that is one aspect of it. Well, you know, I think professional cycling desperately needs a shake up in so many different ways. You know, I was at the Dauphiné last week, and it's visiting a lot of small places in France where there's this real air of complacency. We've seen it all before. People not even necessarily aware that the Dauphiné, which, you know, has some of the biggest stars in the sport, is happening. The racing itself, you know, we talk so often about cycling being the hardest, the toughest, most challenging sport in the world, and you know, we use adjectives like epic and, you know, so forth and so forth, almost ad nauseam. But it often does a very poor job, I think, of conveying just how hard it is, and you don't necessarily get the sense that there's really aggressive racing and the guys are really kicking lumps out of each other, which they are. I mean, one example, the first day of the Dauphiné, okay, Thomas de Gendt went away, got the yellow jersey, but the peloton came in together, and it, you know, on TV, to be honest, it kind of looked like they'd rolled in. And then you go and speak to guys afterwards, and they're almost insulted when you say to them, well, that was a pretty routine first day to the Dauphiné for you, Chris Froome. And he says, well, no, you should see my power meter or whatever. The Hammer Series already had the great merit of really conveying just how hard and aggressive and how dramatic and spectacular it felt to be in amongst all of, you know, in amongst that racing. And I thought that was an interesting aspect of it.
Yeah, I think it's very important to say that we can be positive about the Hammer Series while not advocating that it replaces road racing as we know it. You know, the monuments, the Grand Tours are kind of fine as they are, but it is interesting that ASO... you know, your interview with Christian Prudhomme a few weeks ago, Daniel, was interesting. His attention had clearly been caught by the Hammer Series and by what they were doing. Ashley Mulman Passio, the South African rider, writes for Cervelo Bigla, was one of the riders I spoke to, was quite negative about ASO, as she put it, using the female riders as guinea pigs. She sees it very much as them being used as guinea pigs for innovations that they will look to perhaps roll out in the future, in maybe not in the Tour de France initially, but in maybe in other ASO races. I don't know. I mean, if it's good, if it's entertaining, I'm looking forward to La Course. I think it will be really interesting, that chase with individual riders rather than teams this time. It'll not have the complications that the team time trial had, because you'll have teams coming together, riders. You could have three or four riders from one team in that top 20, and they can ride together, not, you know, unlike in a normal time trial. So it could be really, really interesting.
Yeah, one thing, I think the La Course is a brand new event, isn't it? And that's something that, okay, the term guinea pigs has been used, but it is a new event, and then something new has to be done with it, and that there's an opportunity to do that there. One area where we have to be really careful in professional cycling at the minute is with the historic races, with the races that have been around for a long, long time. We don't upset people by getting rid of those, changing them too much in terms of bringing all the new formats straight into those. We've got to look after a huge selling point for the sport, which is the history, which are the stories, which is the drama that's been built up over a period, in most of these races' case, over 100 years. And that is something that we've got to keep and work and look after. The new stuff, as you said, it might necessarily not be the racing that takes over on the calendar, but if things can trickle down, if elements can be brought in, that has to be something positive for the sport.
And just finally, Rich, on the idea of the chase, which a lot of people sort of rolled their eyes at, and when they saw it, they said it was chaos, it was a huge bun fight. And yeah, I think the format probably does need to be adapted. I would actually introduce drafting. You should be allowed to draft teams, should be allowed to follow each other, because I think that would it would introduce another chaotic element, but it would be a fascinating element and a tactical element. But it almost seemed as though, and I think even the skeptics, even the people who didn't enjoy or watch the whole Hammer Series, probably saw the finale with Theo Gegenhardt just holding on to win it for Sky, it almost seemed as though this was a perfect storm of, and it was a one in a million occurrence that you were going to have a finish like that. I actually think the very nature of the event is such that that would be a quite common occurrence, and that is the nature of a chase and a pursuit. And I think you would see a lot of very, very exciting finales with that particular format.
Well, we wait for the next ones with interest, don't we? And we will hope to get to one of the Hammer Series events as well. One of the things that Teo Gegenhart mentioned was that John Dibben's family were there, and they said that the experience watching it was good as well. There was a lot of stuff going on for spectators. There were a lot of screens, a lot of information for them, perhaps more for them than for the viewers at home at some points. But anyway, it's a work in progress, isn't it? And I think we can be, as I say, quite positive about the first effort.
Just on that, Rich, all of the sort of the trappings and the kind of peripheral entertainment, I'm going to read out a final newspaper clipping that I found about 2020 cricket. And this was Simon Barnes in the Times in June 2003. It's the trappings I can't stand, the garnish, the gimmicks, the wrapping, the ribbons, the packaging, the noise. Music should be banned from all sporting occasions, live and televised. Never mind keeping politics out of sport. If we can keep music out, I'll be happy. Was there much music at the Hammer Series? There were a lot of people posting clips of MC Hammer.
I don't know, but I mean, certainly Europop and cycling are not the strangers to each other that cricket and loud music would be. I think the cricket audience would make the cycling audience look quite rock and roll. I mean, the cycling audience can be pretty conservative, but the cricket audience is an extreme case, I would imagine. I don't really know the cricket audience as well as you two do.
All you have to do is go to Valkenburg the night before Amstel Gold, and it's literally pumping.
It's literally pumping.
It is.
On that note, we should wrap things up for this week, chaps. Maybe we'll join you in Mallorca next week again. In the meantime, thank you very much, Rob.
Thank you. Gracias.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, Rich.
Adios.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.